8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Knotfest.com presents Talk to Me. With over 300 interviews under his belt and 6 years running, your host Joshua Toomey interviews metal and rock's heaviest hitters. Follow the show at Talk to Me Talk. Here's your host, Joshua Toomey.
What is up, everybody? Welcome into Talk to Me here on Knotfest.com. This is the 6 year anniversary of Talk to Me. And in the past, we have had amazing guests on the anniversary shows. Max Cavalera, John Connolly, Glenn Benton, Phil Anselmo, Burton C. Bell. And the 6 year anniversary guest is none other than the mighty Jason Newsted. Jason is on to talk about the 30th anniversary of the Black Album. I got my box set in the mail the other day. I will be doing an unboxing on Knotfest Twitch. That will be Friday night at 5:30 Eastern, so come hang out with me there. But this is an hour-long chat with the mighty Jason Newsted. Huge thank you to Michael Alago for helping me set this up. What a crazy world we live in, where Michael Alago will help facilitate an interview for me. Great friend to have in the music business. Make sure you guys are heading over to Knotfest.com, becoming a Knotfest VIP, checking out exclusive videos from the Talk to Me podcast. Now, the videos from this episode have started to trickle out on YouTube. Parts 1, 2, and 3 are out. Part 4 will be out when this podcast comes out. So all 4 episodes of the Jason Newsted interview are up on YouTube, already pushing like 55,000 views. The damn thing's already gone viral, and the episode's not even out yet. So make sure you're heading over to Knotfest YouTube, checking out this interview over there, also leaving a nice kind comment and defending me from some of the trolls on there. Always fun to see the trolls jumping into the comment section. If you are new to the Talk to Me podcast, welcome. You have 300 plus episodes to go back and check out now. If you dig this interview, make sure you are sharing with your Metallica fan friends. And if you dig the podcast, make sure to leave a nice 5-star rating, nice 5-star review on whatever podcast app you use. Also tonight, post night, if you want to hang out with me over on Knotfest Twitch, Throwback Throwdown with Toomey will be 5 to 7 p.m. And the guests tonight are Heidi Shepherd and Carla Harvey of Butcher Babies, along with Lena Scissorhands of Infected Rain, all three ladies together. I'm assuming it's going to be an absolute madhouse. It's going to be a lot of fun getting all three of those together in one interview. And make sure to come hang out with me 5 to 7 p.m. Eastern, Knotfest Twitch. That is twitch.tv/knotfestofficial. Finally, without any more of my ramblings, let's talk Metallica's Black Album with the one, the only, Jason Newsted. Well, Jason Newsted, man, welcome to the Talk to Me podcast here at Knotfest.com. What an honor and privilege to have you on the show today.
Well, thank you.
So you did recently did the unboxing of the Black Album box set there. Have you had a chance now to sit down with it and go back through memory lane, listen to some of these old interviews and your old riff tape, anything like that?
No, I've actually not pulled on any of the product out to do anything with yet. What was that? Within a couple of weeks ago, that was, yeah. Right? So that was a good moment, dude. It really was. I don't stay really on top of it too much. I try to stay aware of what goes on, you know, and keep an eye on the business and part of it and all that. But I knew they were leading up to this. I knew there was brewing. I'd have been asked to do some liner notes some months back and stuff. When I know I'm going to be talking to people and have interviews and things, I start trying to conjure up things to talk about. And, you know, one of my favorite parts about doing interviews is I always learn something from somebody. And then they bring something up that I wouldn't have thought of, take me down another portal, you know, and sometimes you get a 75-minute answer. It's just too bad for everybody because it opens up right. That kind of a thing for me. It went in so deep then. that I don't think it's coming out, you know? I mean, only in a good way. It's not ever going away. It's going to come out, but it's not going away. What it did do is come out. I guess that's a good point right there. They sent me that box. I knew it was going to be here waiting at the house when I got back. I was in Florida working with a Chop House band. We only got to play together twice in the last like 20 months, so I'm really, I cherish it an awful lot when we get a moment together. So I took all the time to do that, and I told the Metallica guys when, you know, when I get back, if you have the box there, I'll try to put that thing together as quick as I can when I get home. And so I waited. I didn't look at it or anything. I just left it in the box of the box. And so that day, that morning, I took it out, set it out on there, got my knife out and just set it and set the camera up and did my thing. So it was going to be all first response to everything, just as the, you know, fan fun element, super important in any kind of thing. I didn't know about the unboxing deal. I didn't know it was a thing. I don't pay enough right. attention to the internet to know that it's a thing. I've seen on the guitar show, the guy opens up the nice Gibson or something like that, but they never show the dude, you know, they just show the instrument right. and stuff. So that's the only thing that I ever had a relationship to it. So when they asked me to do this, and the manager sends the links to it, and it shows just James's hand open the thing, but no words or nothing. But in my ignorance, I answered back, "Dude, this blows. Where's the personable? Where's the connection for the fans? What the fuck is happening right. here?" And I'm mad, and I said, "I don't think I want to do this, man. I'm not, unless I can do it my way, I'm not doing it." Because I didn't know any better, right? So I went back, but I did it my way, and I think that it turned out how it's supposed to. I only know the old school way, man. You're going to promote some product. You're going to try to connect with the people. What the fuck, man? I got to be able to see my people, and they see me and all that thing. So that's how I took it on. And, man, it was so genuine, dude. When it all came out like that and seeing those things, and all of a sudden these flashes come back and open real clear.
Oh, yeah.
Open that page up real clear in my head, and I could see it. I swear to God, man, like I said on the thing there, if you sat down with me, I swear I could do probably 85 or 87% of those photos and tell you right when, right where, all that thing and what was happening with everybody at the time and stuff. That's how much I was digging it, you know?
You know, a crazy thing about the Metallica camp is how much stuff is cataloged, and you have interviews and demos and riff tracks, and Lars and the guys, and you guys kept everything. It's insane how much stuff is in the vault there.
It is amazing to me as well. Lars had the perspective all the way back from the beginning. Somehow, I don't know if it was just out of his like only child, having room to put everything away that you wanted to put away, stash, you know, stuff and keep everything that you ever had. When you have brothers and sisters and family and all, you don't really get to do that so much. Right? So he was able to do that, I think, in the beginning. But maybe, once again, he was way steps ahead of us and understood that these archives would become so valuable because of the vision he had for his band. And hope, and the way that he knew, or how much he enjoyed collecting the remnants of the other bands that he loved, or being along with Diamond Head or King Diamond. Well, think about that. King Diamond Head. Or, you know, when they were Merciful Fate and all that kind of stuff. But back then, when he was fans of those guys and he collected all their stuff and make sure to hang on all the passes of little remnants that he got from their, or, you know, tokens that he got from their shows and their gatherings, experiences. And it was always really fucking weird to me, man, from the beginning, where he would keep the hotel rooming list and, you know, every goddamn wow. thing, dude. And I'm kind of, this is a little, some kind of obsessive disorder deal, you know, but now it's pretty wonderful. The back in the day, I'm not sure how he has it. I'm sure it's way outgrown his room that he had back then, but he built this underground place where he would keep all the shit.
Oh, wow.
And remember sometimes got us a little bit pissed. I think me anyway. He was always the connection with everything. His thumb on the pulse of every goddamn thing. Get all kinds of freebies from way back. Man, he had that shit figured out where you reach out to somebody and they send it. Well, they'd always send him four of everything, right? Because how many guys are right. in the band, right? That many. Yeah. But keep all four of them and not tell anybody about anything. So when you go back into his vaults, there's four of every fucking thing of like the whatever magazine or this or that or this print of a Metallica thing or whatever. But because he was on top of it, none of us were on top of it like that. None of us paid attention to it like that or sought it out like that or solicited it. You know, he did. He was way ahead. So thank God he did.
I told you earlier when I was watching A Year and a Half last night, and the quote that hit me different now than it did as a kid was, you said that the Black Album was good for your pride. Now, does that have to do with justice? The pride, you know, obviously not have the lack of bass on Justice, and then the pride of a monstrous bass tone on the Black Album?
Oh, sure. That would be either the first foot or the second foot, you know. So, there was pretty incredible camaraderie built, no matter, like, from the outside, what it looked like. When we went to do this record, and Bob Rock insists that we all sit up, and, you know, around each other, look at each other while we're playing, especially when recording the drum tracks, which took, you know, months and months to do. That built some kind of thing without us even knowing it. It just did. And his whole deal, Bob's whole deal, was that when he came to experience Metallica live, felt it. Felt the weight, you know, a big old bass.
Right.
When it's live, it will move your innards around.
Oh, yeah.
You know, as it should. He didn't think that those properties had been captured yet. And so that was his quest, really was. So no matter what angles everybody came at each other in the beginning from, you know, I killed 9 bears, I did Bon Jovi, I was, you know, all that kind of shit where everybody's kind of posturing and everything. So once we found that place to be able to start working together as a team and allow Bob to guide us through it instead of us just maniacs just doing whatever the fuck, he actually was able to get a bead on each guy individually and then us as a collective, because we change when we're together.
Right.
It becomes all. I think that has a lot to do with the question you're asking about the pride. Okay, I'm still answering the same question. It is the building blocks of this pride that I speak of. It has to do with being in a room for each other hours and hours on end. You know, everybody finding their own way to adjust themselves, right, to be able to withstand it, you know what I'm saying? So everybody had their own choices of how they did things, and we got through it, right? But Bob already had a bunch of kids by that time. He wasn't that much older than us. He was still prime. The best years of anybody that you've ever known, pal, I promise you that, right? So that's the key. You know, we talk about why are the great producers the great producers? Just because he knows how to move the fucking compressor over here and this over here and take one. No, man. Or he's got a nice shirt or something. That ain't why. Okay, it's because of this, right? You know, in wine tasting land, so some sommelier,
right?
So grand sommelier.
Okay.
Yeah. There's like 3 of them. There's 7 billion people on the planet. There's 3 grand sommeliers. You know why? Because only their palate, they're born with that tongue and the buds enough to be able to do that. And they seek them out and they finally find one there and find one there and find one there. There's a handful in that country and a handful in that country, and a handful in that country. But the grand guys that have all the crowns from each country, well, 3 of them, right? Same thing with the guys with the ears. They can hear shit you and me can't, no matter how cool we think we are.
Right.
Right. So that's his thing, man. He already knew what he was capable of. And that doesn't get talked about a lot. You know, he knew he wanted to capture us the way that we actually were, our power. He could do it. He knew how to do it, how to realize it, not just talk it. You know, a lot of cats, good producers all over the goddamn place, but there's only certain guys that have certain ears. You know, that's where the pride comes from. When you got people on your team with those kind of talents, you got James doing that, Lars doing Lars, like, no matter how fucking crazy I went over time with how many ever takes of whatever song, it seems like, dude, that last one was great. We're good, right? I got to do this one thing and this one. Just please, one more take. And you just go. You just try to be as supportive as you can, no matter how wacky it's getting, right? And then these years later, you and me are still fucking air drumming Saga True Parts. Right? We are.
Oh, yeah.
He was that far ahead of us, man. No matter how simple it seemed at the time, because I'm still going back to one of your other questions, Justice and all that, right? And all that crazy progressive, holy shit stuff. Simpling it all down, come down to the bottom of that giant funnel like that in the bottom, and go, like, you know, it all of a sudden comes, hauls all the way back and just holds the weight in that place. Instead of opening the faucet all the way up and going, fuck me, like that, it's holding it back, containing itself with all of that weight and strength. Bob knew how to do it. That microphone does that. That thing does that. That thing does that. I go like that, and it goes boom, right? He knew how to do it. So if we just allowed him to guide us to those places, he set us up for it, right? But he had to know how to handle each cat. You know, there's one kind of thing, if you think about it psychologically and everything. When I go and record my bass, I'm by myself. It's Bob and Randy, and we do our thing. Every once in a while, James come in and say, cool, that's cool, whatever. You know, and then when James does his thing, he wants to be by himself in the vocal booth so he can get all envious, make all the warts and the thing and thing not in front of anybody, so he can just get into his zone, get alone to get in the zone, right? And trusted Bob to be able to capture. No, a little more Hetfield, a little more. You know, I've always seen the videos and all that shit, right? You've seen it freshly, this right. whole thing. So that stuff where he's pulling, he can read James. He knows that pool of talent is there. So how do I, come on, buddy, you got it. One more. Ends up being what it was because he understood how to read that person. He took us in as the next chunk of his kids to be able to guide through whatever they were doing. You know, we came in as these snotty fuckers thinking we were all badass and pride, you know, thinking we were tough. We didn't know about pride yet. We were proud. We were proud of our touring. We knew we worked hard and all that kind of thing, but we didn't feel that kind of pride until the continuity of the sound quality of that record.
There's a spot in there where you're doing Inner Sandman. You're kind of playing a bass line that obviously didn't make the record. And Bob's like, it's too busy. And James is like this. And everybody's doing that. I mean, how guarded of your bass lines were you going in? You're like, no, this is the bass line. This is what I'm playing. This is what's going on the record.
I was thinking about this earlier today that, you know, if you take 30 or 40 or 60 takes of a song, in 1 week or a couple weeks' time, and you get it so refined and so honed to every little fucking nuance, yeah? Because you're not just gonna sit there and fucking wank it. You know, you sit there and just go, duh. No, you could try to make something happen. And back then, everything was being recorded, but everything got scratched because we were only focusing on the drums being recorded. I recorded my bass parts full, great, and colorful and shit, 30 or 40 right. times on each song probably that got scratched. That were things that could have been songwriting credit changing type of stuff. But it never got listened to or the time, you know, it was never given the time of day. We didn't have that kind of time to go back on unless I made notes, wrote it down, so I specifically want to listen to that part. It wouldn't have really mattered. We were focused on drums. We're all in the room together. James the guitar, scratch, everything scratched except for the drums. So composed it as we got there, did the best I could with all the coloring, whatever. When you get in the room with Bob, the microscope's on, the red light is on, the foam pad's in front of you. You got all fucking hunkered down, thinking about 20 things every second, trying to make it just perfect like that. You know, it's a totally different ball of wax. I could have remembered what I played of the color of the thing that I was feeling in the room with my boys at the moment. You know, when I'm by myself and doing that, and everything is so, you know, what do you call it? A1 lab condition shit. You know, it needs to be, it's just really focused on service to the vocal. Any fucker that's playing an instrument in the band is service to the vocal. That's it. If you're going to have real songs and real things and get people's attention and go around and make money at it and shit, if you can't get in that mindset, you might as well find something else to do.
Talking about songwriting credits, your lone songwriting credit on there is My Friend of Misery. I'm assuming the bass line that opened the song, you wrote that. Where did that come from? And where were you thinking when that came out?
Nothing too crazy conscious or anything like that. I was in my house in Walnut Creek, California. It just actually the house that Justice built. And I had just gotten my Spectre bass, the first one, or I think the first one. And I was in the living room and playing this mellow, pretty thing, you know. Up to that time, I pretty much played Flotsam style, you know. And the songs that I listened to or played with Metallica or anything like that was all pretty busy Motorhead fueled stuff. So my girlfriend at the time, she heard that thing in between a bunch of rattling shit and really liked it. And so I developed it in a three or four minute revolving, three parts revolving. Kind of like a little trance deal. The initial idea, I think I might have been watching a Nathan East video. He was playing his white Yamaha bass. Okay. And he was showing some scale. And I thought it was pretty tricky. He had his fingers way stretched out. And back then, you know, man, you probably are aware, everything's about agility, being able to, you know, like a lot of competition and who can play fastest and who can do all that kind of stuff. Real, probably still is to this day. I'm just not in it anymore like that. But it used to be, you know, that much, very much. We're pioneering Exodus and Metallica and Megadeth and Flotsam and all that, trying to outdo each other with tempos and craziness, right? So that was, where was I even going with this, dude?
I got so talking about my friend of misery opening bass line, and you put it together and send it over.
Yep, so it is. Yeah, so that's, my girl liked it. I worked it out, got kind of quiet, and I think that back then when I recorded my demos, it would just be the bass parts. You know, I just wrote stuff on bass. You know, when I wrote Flotsam songs, I write some on bass, and then the guitar would do that, you know. Now I write on guitar mostly, have for the last how many ever years. But the demos or the idea tapes that I would give to Lars and James were just bass lines rattling about. And so I think that within that, the mellowness of that one and the tranciness of that one took their attention more than just the kind of samey stuff that was around it. And I think they were always attracted to my unorthodox kind of thing. It was quite a few steps away from where Kirk was writing or James was writing. You know, like Blacken and stuff, Sideways, man. No idea of any kind of music theory or whatever. That just is dexterity, and it seemed fast and it was off and weird. So let's go with that. It has no kind of formality or properness to it. And the same thing with any of the ones that I guess probably got chosen or even messed with in Metallica. It was never orthodox. the ones that they ended up choosing anyway were very much off to me.
Yeah, something like a King Nothing and, you know, things like that. Yeah, very.
Yeah, that's an off too. You know, that's James's bass line.
Oh, okay. Maybe he was channeling his inner Jason.
It could have been. I know that there's no way that certain things at certain times and parts couldn't have crept their way into some of the songs without saying that guy had those four notes and that guy had those six notes and stuff. It's just not. That was the least of my concern back then, bro. You know, I'm happy now that I got to take part in those songs, the songwriting thing. But I was about the show. I was about making it happen. I was about being loud as fuck and all that. And that, you know, I just didn't have the wherewithal yet to understand the business or the how it works or any of that. Man, you set me up all those shows. I'll try not to be weak for any of them. That's all I knew.
And which you definitely were not. So August 12th, 1991, man, tell me about that day. How that day kind of changed your life, man.
Yeah. We had done a couple of opening shows. You always try to, like, after you're coming off the album part of the cycle and everybody's a little bit rusty because you're just all studio tanned and shit. Right. So you come on, try to get exposed to the people. We always do a few preach to the converted kind of shows, you know, so that one to any warts or any bumps or any shit's going to take place. Have it be in front of people that don't care. You're just happy to see you. So we did the Petaluma. It was on Petaluma. Just, you know, we all had to drive, I don't know, an hour out of HQ or something. And set up in a theater. I wish I could tell you the name of it right now. Anyway, Phoenix Theater. And did three nights there, August 3rd, so that was James's birthday and something other right there in that same week, warming up for the Black Album. So by the time the Black Album came out, I think we were already on the road. We were headed to somewhere or playing our first couple of shows. Yes, we were. We were in Denmark playing by the 10th of August. So which is included in one of the Black Album, blah, blah, blah. Yeah.
You can buy now at Metallica.com.
Yep, exactly. That was that show. So we were already hitting it before the album was actually globally released. We were amongst it when it came out. So yeah, pretty back to the pride thing. Maybe that'll be the theme of our conversation. Very prideful. You know, the group of support system, the team that was in place then to make it all possible for us was so solid. And prideful would be the word I would use to describe anyone that was involved. Very excited and very prideful. We can fucking do this. Watch us. You know, every record store guy, manager guy from the record company in Portugal guy, and every fucker, man, It was really something. Everybody felt the same way about it, knew we had something special, and everybody's putting their all in it because they knew it was at stake. You know? And it worked.
Were you keeping up with record sales? Were you guys getting, you know, weekly, daily updates on how many millions this thing is selling, and was it blowing your mind each time you heard another million went off the shelves?
That part of things became kind of more like Monopoly money deal. I think it's hard to really fathom those kind of things. Once again, the main key, we were amongst it at the time. So if you're some of the times, you know, we do what we do, it could be in three cities in one day. You know, so you wake up in the city that you played the last night, you fly to the city that you're playing in, you leave that city to go to the next city, like that, in one 20 to 24 hour period. So that's and that, you know, day after day, week after week, month after month, year after year. Not for everyone, my man. So anyway, that's how it all went down. There's always two times in the show day that we get kind of like, I used to call it pep talk in a way, the morale builder of sorts. In the center of the inner sanctum, in the very dressing room, there's 10 or less people allowed. Yeah. And so the money man would come in, and that time it was Tim Duffy, pretty sure, and or Tony DiCiaccio, and they'd come in before the show. Because Lars was always, that's how I'll start the answer, is that Lars was always on top of every bit of that all the time, keeping an eye on where, he had it together, dude, he still does, but beaming it down, like, where do we need to go? Okay, that this tour, and if we're going to add the shows up there 8 months from now, that needs to be boom, 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 like that kind of shit. Really, really on top of it. Really on top of it. So the before the show, the dude would come in and say, there's that many tickets sold, you got this little thing, and at this time you're speaking of exactly in these months, in these first 5 to 7 months of the Black Album, it just went double platinum in Malaysia. It just did whatever like that. You know, right. He would say it's so that we went out the show going, that's right, you know, that kind of shit. It was psychological. It was also genuine. He was fucking psyched too, man, you know? And Lars loved to hear it. So, and then he would come back after the show, and he would say, okay, boys, we did that many tickets. We did that many. He would just say a figure, and that meant how much money per head in the room, meaning that many people by average spent that much on T-shirts, beer, and so-and-so. And you just go, you know? So they just that one more morale booster, you go get on a plane a half an hour from there and keep it going and keep it going, keep rocking. That's what you needed psychologically. And Lars, I think for all of us, especially, though, he would never deny it, the ego of it.
Oh, yeah.
Was just fantastic, you know, really, no doubt.
Throughout your time in Metallica, the one thing that you was constant was you always wear a Metallica shirt on stage. I almost wore a Talk To Me shirt today in honor of you because, you know, you was that a semblance of you still being a fan? Was it just you like the merch? What was that to wear the shirt all the time?
I believed in myself and I believed in my band.
How many of those Sad But True shirts did you go through throughout the tour?
You mean as far as shredding them and that kind of stuff?
Yeah.
Or, I would keep most of the same ones. I would always take on whichever new design came at what place. You know, I would do whatever I could, what was within my power, to promote and forward our success. I would sacrifice myself in any manner asked. There were no limits. I would do whatever it took to what I could possibly do in my limited knowledge and experience to play my role to the best of my ability to make us successful. Flying the colors made me, as Jason Isbell says, black metal t-shirt my shield. It was, you know, and it always was, and it was the name of my fucking band across the front. And guess what? There is no bigger one. So I pridefully wear this. I fly my colors more prideful than any Hell's Angel or whatever through all of time, right? And one little side note, Joshua, that goes along with the doing what I can for the cause if you go back and you talk to the guy after the show that comes to tell Lars about the dough, you know, says, by the way, Jay, you know, the executioner shirt you've been wearing the last 3 days, it's outsold everything else by 40%.
Right.
So take that with you, okay? And that mean, and everybody gets that money, right. Okay? Manager, crew guy, band guy, everybody shares in that money, okay? There you go, bro.
There you go. Now, that's the best reason to wear it. Talk about a go ahead.
The best, a great dividend.
You know what I mean. Share the wealth, Jason. Share the wealth. As long as the crew guys are getting helped out. Talk about a couple shows on that run. The Day on the Green, 91 show. Man, tell me a little bit about what you remember from Day on the Green 91.
Coming home as champions, you know, for sure. Returning as heroes. How's that go? Is that something like that?
Something like that, yeah.
Returning as heroes. So many people there from the beginning and the early fandom and all that, and the beginning of the foundation of the Bay Area thrash scene and the sport. Everybody knew there was something special there, okay? All of the cream rises to the top. We know which Bay Area bands are bad motherfuckers, and there's a lot of them, but there's ones that rose, and there's a reason why. When you're in that heavy a competition, man, you got to be on your toes. And so we fortunately had Lars's foresight, James's riffs, you know, and all of our tenacity together to be able to get to that place and go around like we're talking about, man. Take all those doses of dopamine, all the doses of adrenaline, all the things back and forth from the people, good and bad, that happen out on the road, all the stuff within each other when you're elbow to elbow every fucking day, and still being able to support each other and go out and not ever want to be the weak one on the stage. Make sure that everybody together is like, right on, dude, we can do this. We can do this. When you're having a bad day and your boys come around still, come on, bro, we can do it. That type of shit. It was all intact like it should have been. So we had done, a handful of shows when we came back for that. We'd been out for a few weeks or something and making it just firing on all cylinders, man. From the time that the Phoenix Theater to that, whatever that was, a couple months later, man, we were primed up, buddy. And I had the Alembic basses going. You know, Santa Rosa, they built me all these custom JN basses running on a 6-string, weighed about 40 fucking pounds. I mean, I'm exaggerating a little bit, but it was heavy. The 6-string solid maple for Sad But True with that top string about that big around, you know. And you could just see people in the front of the bass was just going, what the? You get the sternums coming out. Boom. Pretty good shit, man, for real. But they, I think that was one of the best shows that we ever played. And because we were pridefully showing off for our homeboys, right? The guest list at that one, dude, was half of the fucking stadium. That's not much exaggeration on that one.
How did the Bay Area guys take you? Obviously, you know, being a Michigan Phoenix guy, kind of coming into Metallica. Any animosity there?
Dude, you know, I didn't get to spend a whole lot of time amongst everybody. It wasn't the same as like the hang earlier on when Metallica moved from Los Angeles to San Francisco and kind of built their thing there. By the time that I again got in, we were rolling. You know, I was home for 20 days a year or some shit. Like, you know, for the most part, got support and, you know, like camaraderie from everybody. There's quite a good handful of recordings of Exodus guys from 86 or 87, you know, all the way back. And Rob from Machine Head with their Violence. And you know, those kind of guys, man, they would always be pretty good to me. I say the majority of people were really quite good to me. Any of the bands that I respected, for sure. Yeah, when I was out, I just didn't have much time to get out then.
Another show around that time was the Moscow show, which actually, for some reason, Pantera gets more video acclaim for that show. But, you know, you guys were higher up on the bill. But, you know, they always play, like, Pantera's Domination, things like that, as it was a Pantera show. But that was much, much, much a Metallica show.
Pantera was out at 10 a.m.
Right.
And that's how wicked they were. See, now that's, speaking of the cream of the crop.
Yeah.
When you have enough hours, days, years in together, and you become one, you become a part of something that's bigger than any of you. You know, it's a grand example right there of the hours, the determination, and the pride that they had. I remember those guys getting off because they were the only ones that I think weren't on the plane with us. So when, I don't know if you know the story, if you want me to tell it again.
No, go ahead.
People have heard it before, probably a few times, I've told it a few times, but you know, we were in the Eastern Bloc touring with AC/DC at the time, right? There was still a lot of still communist nations that hadn't been switched over to Slovenia, blah, 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 this thing yet. And the coup starts happening in Russia. And word comes out, there's kind of mumblings amongst the managers and stuff like that. And we heard some kind of things are going to go play this big show somewhere. And so we got a message from a prime minister representative from Russia or something. Got through to our management. And they had talked to the kids that stood up to the tanks, you know, the leaders of the resistance, or whatever you want to call that. What would you like in reward for saving us all? You know, we want American rock and roll. We want Guns N' Roses. We want Metallica, you know. So AC/DC and Metallica right around the corner as far as it goes. Time Warner gets behind the whole thing. They see a giant opportunity to make world history, which it is now become. They send this plane for us. Black Crowes, AC/DC, and Metallica were all together playing some shows. I think they were like Monsters or Rock labeled shows or something in Europe.
I believe so, yeah.
Eastern Bloc, yeah. And this plane shows up, and it's man, we could fit this room inside part of it for sure.
Right.
You know, you have like couches and full fucking deal, man. I never seen nothing like it. We've been on a couple of nice planes, but this was insane. Really, because it was a big ass plane, right. Like a proper big plane where you stand up and walk run around and shit. So being on a plane with Angus and Malky and all those guys at one time, you know, going through your mind like Big Bopper, man, fucking you know, Buddy Holly and the day metal died and whatever, all this crazy shit, and everybody's all joking about it because it was still quite a time where we everybody imbibed still. We're talking about 91, man. Everybody still hit whatever they wanted to hit back then. You know, kind of making the rules on our own, getting away with an awful lot. I remember we had all landed and stuff, and it's probably, you know, it could have been anywhere. I mean, it could have been where you're sitting right now in the town, went out in the town, played where you are, and the kid's right there, his Metallica shirt and his album to be signed, and they're just like any fucking where else we've been. But it's Russia, and the album the kid has is a 6 months' wages. The shirt he's wearing is an offshoot, but it was still 6 months' wages.
Right.
You know, that kind of, you get a little perspective on that shit. It ain't Hot Topic down the road. You know, was none of that happening. So I remember Pantera came in a little bit late. And they get off their bus, and we're already in. They're kind of hanging. And they were fucking shot, dude. They'd been from, I don't know, man, they could have swam from Dallas for all I know. Really.
Yeah,
that's where they were. They'd been through the flights and the thing and the thing. They got up that next morning and crushed every fucker. You know, they had to be like 8:30 in the morning to get a thing going, man. They probably had an hour and a half of sleep at that, and they got right in and started hitting the beers with us and stuff. So it's like, you know, like once again, not for everyone. And then them for it to be able to pull that off. And it was so perfect. The graininess of the black and white, somewhat sepia film. And, you know, like they had their fresh ears, man. All these people building up to this thing, and there's how many? There's only a few hundred thousand across the field at that time.
Right.
A mere quarter million at 10 in the morning. Whatever the fuck, man, right? A lot of people that are in the morning. Perfect for these guys. Perfect. The way the film came off, the way of Diamond. Come on, dude. Untouchable.
Oh, yeah.
Right? Phil with the mask and the thing and the dude vicious. I watched that way more than I ever watched Metallica. I tell you, Primal Concrete Sledge, man, just they throw that down, forget it.
Mm-hmm.
He's like, follow that, motherfuckers. It was pretty good. It's pretty good, gotta say. But it was perfect element for them. We all were in weird states of mind, I guarantee you, coming into that thing. There was nothing normal about it. Dressing rooms were army tents. You know, like just not anything normal. You've seen the film. Helicopters 30 feet above people's head. The fuck is that all about? Weird. But anyway, we still came off, dude. And I remember not getting in trouble, but like being frowned upon a little bit. I went up on Angus's Habit Trail.
Okay.
Up all the way up on the climbing way. I'm not supposed to do that. Oh, the Angus is supposed to do that when the lights are on later tonight. But I was like, oh, man, come on. This is one time.
There's a million people here.
We can go up and run around for a minute. If I can get lost up there.
How often were you watching the crowd, watching the helicopters, trying to see from side to side, you know, taking it? What did it take away from your performance at all, kind of getting lost in the moment?
It was a considerable different demand on your awareness, consciousness, than just the average, you know, watching a bottle fly by or somebody throwing some shit or a fan coming up behind you or whatever like that. It made different awareness. You always got to be that. Your head's on a swivel, having to remember every song that's coming up. You know, we don't have sheet music on the fucking stage, dude. It's like there's, you know, 2.5 hours of songs up here waiting to be executed perfectly. And if you miss one note, you all look at each other like, you know, it's got to be. People are coming to see Metallica, dude. Okay, so, yeah, it needs to be, you know. You got to be on your toes. So it added a way different thing. It was undeniable. What is it? I don't know if it's the word's perpetual, but it had to be all. It had to be constant's the word. There was no way to come off the vigilance of got to get to that mic, get over there. But it was, I was watching a lot of things that we would usually stop the show for. If I was in Wichita, if I was in Indianapolis, if I was in New York City and we saw that happen in the crowd, we would stop the show and make sure that that person got helped before we continued the song. All right. We couldn't do that. Right. So that was quite a bit different element.
Yeah. You definitely see that. Obviously in the Pantera footage, they show a lot of the, cops beating the kids and things like that. Yeah, it was pretty rough.
Dude, so keep that thought for a second. That was the first hour. Okay, it still went 14 hours after that,
yeah,
into the dark with no lights outside, only the lights from the stage. And what, 400 portatoles for fucking 800,000 people? What, you know, come on. It was brutal, dude. People died and people were born. You know, it was heavy as fuck.
Good thing there wasn't Facebook and Twitter back then. There'd be a lot of people complaining about the traffic or something, you know. Great show, but I was stuck in traffic for 12 hours.
Oh, man. You know, because it was a free concert, right? Oh. And it was in the middle of there. And every national radio, like national public radio from each of the Baltic states and all that shit, announced it's a free concert with these American rock bands. And they got to say AC/DC and Metallica next to each other. So people started coming from, well, they were in the days before all around the town. But dude, the things that we learned there, I can only speak for myself right now. My other boys can tell their own stories, but the sobering experiences in that place made me appreciate every single sip of coffee that I have every day. Appreciate hot water coming out of the spigot when I turn the H on. Clean hot water comes out at me. Don't take that shit for granted, all right? I'm telling you right now. That's what that place taught me. And I'd been to some pretty rough places, but that place for an established nation was, yeah, man. Sobering, bro.
Absolutely. As we kind of wind down, man, you know, there's never going to be another Metallica. And I don't think there's ever going to be another Black Album. Time, place, circumstance for everything. You know, now any new band that comes out now, half the people like them, half the people hate them. But it seemed like at the time, man, Metallica was a force to be reckoned with that didn't take no for an answer, I guess.
There are a few very important elements that made this concoction come together, percolate, and, you know, do what it did. Start out with the hard work of the band. So you go back to 83. So the boys are already doing the Kill 'Em All for One, playing Europe, getting their following in Europe before America even knew who they were. Did the hard work, went on the road, roughed it. Do we have to do the first couple times around? Is always the toughest, right? And then lose Cliff. Devastating that will never be ever forgotten, or, you know, never be able to come away from the changes that were made there inside the people. And then I come in and we work 4.5 years pretty fucking hard, buddy. And then a lot of places, 30 or 35 countries by that time, once we were kind of wrapped that all up and made up for the shows with Cliff and then went on to the Justice stuff and everything. Worked very hard. And we're talking again about the team that was established from carpenter to manager to every person that took the pride in the band and was there to do whatever was needed to make it happen, right? Everybody willing to work all hard and lose all the sleep necessary and everything to be victorious. That's the beginning. So you got what the tools that you need to work with. Next comes the arrangement of that. So when the managers work it out that they set you up with all these opportunities amongst the demographic of how many ever millions of people that are 12 to 32 years old that would get down with a loud guitar music across the globe, because we were global already and we were ready for that chance. It was set up. It was like just waiting for us to take it, you know? So the record comes out and it sounds great right across the board. And it covers a bunch of ground, you know, the weighty stuff, speedy stuff, good heavy stuff in the middle. And the secret of it all, secret, I don't know, it's what came in, and now we know is knowledge and fact. The softest song that we ever had is called Nothing Else Matters, and up to that point. And there was already Fade to Black and things like that, but the radio, only certain college radio or something like that would ever play that song. There was never a thing. There was never appeal like that for Metallica to it. As Nothing Else Matters comes out as the third single or whatever it was, ask Lars about that stuff. It comes a little bit later, you know, that time we already been out on the road and building the following. The softest song broke down the tallest, strongest barriers for battery and fire to get through, right? We couldn't have done it the other way around. It would not have worked the other way around. Right. The radio the way it was at the time, the listeners of that radio the way it was at the time across the globe, ready for that song to appeal to everybody, right? So not just the people who are going to come to the concert to hear the heavy shit. Now it's all this starts to be getting to the mainstream of things, an addition, because we have, people from the heavy still want to see it too. So all of a sudden it goes from 30 to 50 countries that they want us to play in. And we get around the road for, you know, going back to what you hear, where were you when? So we're like 5 or 6 months into the thing. And a dude comes into the dressing room and says, Nothing Else Mattered, number one in 30 countries this week. 30 countries this week. Like, And they've asked us to come to Timbuktu, that never would give us the time of day before. Right? So they set us up. That's my point here. The managers, promoters, and all those things, radio people, the team that made that all happen, they set us up for the next shows. Set us up for success, we went and crushed them. Anything that they would set up for us, we would go and take care of business like everyone expected us to do. So the promoter would ask us back again, so that you would get going, like that, right? We were set up by those people to do that. So those elements are all in place. You understand all those elements. Now take the one chronologically that actually made it all possible. AC/DC and Iron Maiden from early 80s. Up through the time that we were coming to that spot right there. They had played those 35 or 37 or 39 or whatever it was, those countries that would allow westernized heavy music by that time. It wasn't, you know, this thing couldn't keep it, or communism, Islam, whatever, didn't keep it from coming there. They went to all those places first. They knocked down the first batch of trees and kind of gave us a rough road. Some of the places they paved that shit in some of the bigger cities, you know? But in those outskirts and stuff, they broke down and then we had to go through and make it happen. If they wouldn't have come and done those places for those people in that and making the fandom of heavy music foundation, right, then we wouldn't have been able to do what we did either. So all those things together I just explained aligned like planets, and we had enough conviction as a collective to do it. And as individuals, the determination and the talent, but also not ever wanting to let the other guy down. Because one of our cardinal rules within the band is you never want to be the weak one on the stage.
Right.
Ever. So whatever it takes, Kirk Yoga, Jason Bicycle, Lars running every day, whatever the hell you need to do to be that, that's what you do as an individual. So the understanding of all the people within it knew that we were made of that. So they put their efforts into it, and that collective effort became something we're talking about 30 years later right now.
Well, normally I would end right there because that was the perfect way to end it, but I do need to do one thing. I've had Michael Gilbert on the podcast twice, but yeah. We always end up talking about you, So now we need to flip the script and talk about how amazing the last few Flotsam and Jetsam records have been.
Michael Gilbert is a bad motherfucker. All right? That's it. So we're speaking about tenacity and all that kind of thing and loyalty. At the poster child right there. You know, he came into our band, he was 16 years old.
Little guy.
And we had to sneak him, and he had the cool, you know, he already had way cooler gear than us, and he could play that crazy Slayer shit and everything. We're like, okay. But melded right in, and we used to have to sneak him into the club, you know, we get permission from the club guy. Okay, he's not going to drink or nothing, man. We'll just bring him in through the back. You're going to go on the stage. As soon as we're done, we can take him right back out, okay? And a bunch of times we had to do that. You know, and he hung right in there. And now he's the, you know, spearhead of the band and the heart, you know, still keeping it alive. And so that I have nothing but respect for that. But he's also a real straight shooter of a person, you know, always prepared, very honest, keeps himself fit, does what he says he's going to do, man. You know, that's all I got for that. I don't know if he told you or not, but, you know, when James got burnt, when he got torched by the Montreal magnesium flash, Michael came in and played a couple songs with us.
Oh, really?
We had Jeff from Annihilator.
Oh, wow, yeah.
And Andrew, Jeff Andrews, what's his name?
Jeff Waters.
Jeff Andrews is from Kirk's Exodus. Wow, steel trap, yeah. Dude. What the hell? Jeff, what was it?
Waters.
Waters, Jeff Waters from Annihilator came down. He's pretty tough. Michael came in and played a few songs. Andreas from Sepultura. And that was, you know, that's what I wanted. He's vicious.
Oh, yeah.
Another one of my favorite people. So him and Mike Gilbert, two of my very favorite people. Anyway, so yeah, a lot of respect for Mike and through time for him, you know, flying the Flotsam flag. And you are correct about the quality of the Flotsam music. I got to tell you that, see what you do? So... back in 2012, we had done December 2011. We did the 30th anniversary at the Fillmore, Warfield, Fillmore, with the shows right, through the week there
Fillmore,
with the guests.
And,
yeah. And I got pretty excited. I got kind of screamed back into it. I got the giant adrenaline dose again.
Right, right.
And it was like two weeks went by. I swear to God, it was like 2 weeks went by, and I went back on. Nope. Well, this is what you're supposed to be doing. What the fuck? Well, this is very familiar right now. It felt really good. I was in the right place. I felt strong, you know. I'm going, you know, what are my options here? Am I going to try to play heavy music again for just a second? Seems like everybody still likes me. Let me see. So I can try to get a band together, make a super group. Or you could do, you know, whatever the fuck. The thing's going through my mind. But there's still Flotsam. There's always Flotsam. What about, you know, I heard Kelly came back and everything's going on and... could we get the original recording band of Doomsday together and perform Doomsday in its entirety? And that would be our show. And we'd go and do our, you know, whoever would have us. And I imagine it would end up being a few people, but whoever would have us. And then, so I went to Phoenix in February of 90. Jesus, because he got me a ways back. Woo, buddy. So the fuck, that was quite a while later too, wasn't it? So it was 20 years later. Well, February of 2012.
There we go.
February of 2012. Went to Phoenix a weekend and then took a break. And then the next weekend, it was two weekends of February, and got the guys together, original band. Edward came back out. He was living in California, so he came to Arizona. And we got together and started knocking down the Flotsam tunes. And I'd been working on them the best I could, you know. And I'm like, fuck. I mean, even after playing in Voivod, it was like, this is crazy shit. Even back then, remembering all the speed and the dexterity, I'm like, wow, dude, you guys can you remember what I came up with? It's like just nutty. So many songs came and went since that time. Just wow. So we get in the room together and all five of us are looking at each other. We're all laughing and smiling. We're still alive. We're like, what the hell happened? Right? But it felt so good and it was strong. And by that time, like, I brought my gear and I had my wah and my system and all that. I never had that in Flotsam.
Right.
You know, so like, and there was new dimension to the old songs because of it. You know, the spots where there's bass solos and all that going off and, you know, just cool shit. And tight and snappy. Like snap. Snap is the word. Flotsam has a snap. And the one thing that I think that the thing that left Metallica when I left was Snap. You know, they're just not the same Snap. Just not the same Snap. But the Snap comes along with from Flotsam. That's why I said those words at all right there.
Yeah.
Is because it came from Flotsam, and that's what I brought to Metallica was that Snap. They get together with the guys, and then we just be with each other, go out for some dinners, go out for meals with their families, hang out with their kids for a minute, see what their real world is like, because I've been away from it for so long. You know, I went away from it in 86, and we're talking about that time later, so it's quite 26 years in or whatever, right? So it was quite water under the bridge. They had kids that were already 20 years old and stuff, and whoa. It was a lot for me to take in, or take on, also, because within all of that, that means that would have been my bill and my dime. I'm not afraid of that, but only at certain spots. I'm willing to back the band. I'm willing to get the gear going and hire the crew and stuff like that. But the other stuff can't be my responsibility. So those kind of things would come into play. And because of my nature, I would want to make everybody okay and fix them and all that stuff. So it just was not in the cards. So I put together the other guys for the Newstead band and decided we'd go out and do what we did for that thing. But the stimulation came from trying to go and play with Metallica that first time for the 30th anniversary thing. Anyway, it was cool.
Well, you did have plans for those millions, and it wasn't sandwiches, so.
That's true. And the cool thing is that what worked out is that I was able to have the place that I wanted, and I still can have sandwiches.
And if you ever get the itch to play metal, you know, Megadeth's looking for a bass player, so.
Still?
No, I don't. Well, they have a touring one right now, so.
wasn't that kind of interesting for me?
That was fun.
God, dude, what the, Jesus Christ. What a flip of a thing. But we won't go into the backstory of it, but just that little talk about that, you know, I don't know if I would ever do something like that. It's not it's just not in my purview anymore. I'm so busy with other music and play all the time with other kinds of people. It's just, I like playing the heavy stuff every now and again, but I really enjoy the composition now and proper, like different instruments and dimensions to the songs and three or four voices going and female background vocal and cool shit, you know, like music and whoa. That's way more what I'm after now. Tonight I'm going to go play with this eight-piece band here that I just started my network up in my new home here in New York. And, I'm excited to throw – I've got 10 songs that I've given that I'm going to run them through tonight and see what they're made of. You know, but it's like cool shit, man. You know, Johnny Cash, Ring of Fire, you know, and they got a horn section.
Oh, wow.
You know, I'm going to get some shit going. So that's where I'm at. And if Andreas calls and says, come out and throw down, half an hour of Sepultura with me and somewhere, and I'm there. You know, there's things about, I think this is a good place to talk about it because you've got the ear of quite a few of these people. This thing came out in a Florida interview. I think it was an art exhibit interview, actually. And there was something about, you know, my shoulder surgeries, and I say, oh, I can't play Metallica songs anymore and all this stuff. And people start running with this thing. Like, are you sure that you listened to what I said? You know, are you sure that you heard the words that I said? Or did somebody just run with this part and then they made up this big goddamn thing? But just, I want everybody to realize that if whoever asked me to come and play bass, you know, and if it was for real, then I would be there to play bass. And if it was Metallica asked me to play for that many songs or that fast or that slow or whatever, then I would go and do it. There's not a thing where I can't do that. I was saying it like, I'm probably not going to go on tour and do 2.5 hours every night with a band anymore. That's not just something I'm probably going to do. You know, it's not that I can't do it. That's not something. I already did that a bunch of times. Something that's important for everybody to know. The camaraderie of Metallica, the band that made the Black Album, because this has come up these last few weeks and our, you know, we call it togetherness on it. You know, it's something I'm really happy about. I've always tried to stay on the high road and, always speak, well, here we go, I'm going to wrap it up, baby, pridefully of this band and my experience with these guys and the opportunities that they afforded me and still do to this day. We did something very special and things that happened and the planets that aligned that we've explained here pretty good why it happened the way it happened. But it couldn't happen without the hard work, right? And everybody worked really hard for what we have now and continue to receive. It's not for everyone. That's why there's only a handful of bands that can do it. If you think about the positive influence that this album and this band that made this album have had on so many millions of listeners, and maybe, I'm not sure which one's more important, but, and players. So millions of people pick up a guitar, a bass, or get on the drums because of this record. Not the other albums too, but this record. Okay, this is the one that, you know, in the guitar stores, right, used to say no Stairway, now it says no Sandman. No Sandman. You know, that's how it is now.
Oh, yeah.
What that represents metaphorically is huge, dude. But it's real. How many kids picked up that guitar like we did when we heard Judas Priest record and learned Breaking the Law because it was learnable? And by the way, the same notes. But anyway, it's Sandman. You know, it's just that, and Smoke on the Water is same as Sandman too. So it's just something about those notes that catch everybody, and everybody wants to learn them, and they're so learnable, and inspires people to want to play a little bit and feel the music flow through them. Okay, so that's my point about this babbling, is that once you do feel the music flowing through you, whether it's as a listener really fucking loud and sing along with everybody in the crowd and being a part of something huge like that, or actually playing the music and getting through Sandman at your sixth grade talent contest. You know, how many thousands of kids learned that as their first riff? It's just so, it's an amazing thing that happened. And how could we have ever planned it or anything like that? But that victory within all of that, and how it influenced so many people and will continue, because the people that they influence and stuff. It was just like a pivotal cultural thing from a like heavy metal band, real true throwing down heavy metal band, right? That can still go as heavy as anybody, right? Oh, yeah. Kind of set the standard for that shit. And so that's the greatest part of the success. So you can measure all the thing by the dollars and the thing that the world measures it by. How do they title you? Okay, Robert Duvall or Derek Jeter. It says World Series winning home run champion Derek Jeter, and then it says Grammy award winning or Oscar award winning Robert Duvall. Says Grammy award winning Hall of Famer Metallica. That's how the world sees everything. That's how the world is measured. That's how you're introduced. That's how you're measured, right? This is the way it is. So we have those biggest titles possible preceding our names as individuals and as a collective. That's a pretty big deal, successful in the world's eyes, right? But in the down, emotional, like, thing, guy in his room by himself with his record and his guitar, and that's what he's got because everybody else is just fucking him, or that type of thing, or the world's spinning in an unfathomable way, like now, that you just had in the last couple of years. You got your guitar and you got your song, you got Metallica, you got Slipknot, you got whatever is your band, is your favorite band, you know, that makes you feel a part of something. Okay, that's not something dollars can measure or titles can measure or any of that shit. And you think about the impact of how long this record has been on the Billboard charts, about all the thing. If you go across the thing, there's only two albums now of original songs that have been 600 weeks on the Billboard charts. Two. And how many 800 records come out proper every week and blah, oh my God, right? For how many every years? Pink Floyd, Dark Side of the Moon, and Metallica, the Black Album. There's two others that are on there, but those are greatest hits records. So those don't count. There's two original albums that have been on the charts that long in history, as long as they've been keeping track. And it's a band that goes, die. Oh, man, what the hell, dude?
Yeah.
See, and we're talking about it 30 years later with smiles on our face, and we're all prideful about it and all that shit. Look at us.
Well, you almost got tears in my eyes. You explained me to a T. It was crazy. I was 12 when this album came out. Enter Sandman video pops up, blows me away. I'm buying a bass. I'm buying all the records. I'm buying all the posters. You know, buying all the you know, I think I had 7 Metallica shirts for 7 days in the week, you know. So yeah, I was 100% that kid. And that, you know, honestly, if you want to go back, I mean, I'm not doing this if it wasn't for the Black Album. So, you know, the show and podcasting and everything else, man. Crazy times.
That's the way to wrap that up right there. If it wasn't for us making that record, you might not be sitting right where you're sitting right now doing what you're doing.
Absolutely, right? Man.
You could be president or something instead.
Most likely. But this is way more fun.
I imagine it is. All right.
Well, Jason, man, I would love to do this again. And thanks to Michael Alago for what kind of crazy world am I living in when I can reach out to Michael Alago to set up a Jason Newsted interview? I'm just like, so crazy, man. What a great dude.
The beautiful world is what that is.
Yeah, right.
Beautiful world. See, that kind of world gives you hope.
Right.
Right? We could all use a little bit of that right now.
Thank you to Jason Newsted for taking the time. How crazy is that to even say? For taking the time here on the Talk To Me podcast, celebrating 6 years of podcasting. So make sure to go and check out the back catalog if you're new to the podcast. And if not, thank you guys for sticking around, hanging out, and getting bigger and bigger guests each and every week. Yeah, not much more to say on that one. That was a fun episode. Make sure to share with your friends, rate, review, subscribe. And for the Talk To Me podcast, I am Joshua Toomey.
The Talk To Me podcast presented by KnotFest.com. Follow the show at Talk To Me Talk. Be sure to subscribe, rate the podcast, and leave a review on your favorite podcast app to get the latest from the Talk To Me podcast.